Coming up next is the Professor James McCanny Science Hour at the Crossroads. Now on shortwave, WWCR, frequency 5.070 at 7 p.m. Eastern on Thursdays, and also on Reality Radio Network Internet at www.realityradionetwork.com on Thursday evenings at 9 p.m. Eastern. And now, once again, here's your host, the Professor.
Good evening, February 22nd, 2007. And first of all, I want to talk about the book release. I've had to postpone it just a little, and so keep tuned. All I can tell you is there is work going on in the background. That's the most I'm going to say about it, but it is very close to being released, and arranging for many of the details that go along with this release, which is a bit more complicated than other books that I've dealt with in the past. And when you see it, you will understand why. So just keep tuned, and keep tuned to my webpage. You will see the announcements coming out shortly. On to just a reminder, if you have not already, excuse me, listen to the archive of my January 11th, 2007 radio show. Make sure you do, on the topic of repeatability. Okay, so I'm going to move rather quickly into the main science topic for tonight's show, dealing with ownership of resources, science, etc. And this is rather a timely topic in light of two international incidents that appeared in the news this past week. One being the sale and installation in the Czech Republic of an anti-ballistic missile system coming from the United States, and the Russian reaction to that. The second being and this looks like it's been in the works for a long time, and I always like the excuses they use, that the UN, the United Nations, is taking over NASA. Now, that may come as a little bit of a surprise to you. However, I've been imagining this going on for quite a while, and actually, when you start hearing these kind of issues in the news, you have to understand all of the background work has already taken place. You're just getting kind of the letter in the mail after the fact, so to speak. So anyway, I'll be talking about that and what it means to you, what it means, and how they're doing this. The excuse, so to speak, for the United Nations taking over control of NASA. So at any rate, this past week, and then I'm going to also talk about the science of getting rid of asteroids, near-Earth asteroids, as a potential hazard to Earth and what that entails. So these are somewhat unrelated issues, but they turn out to be very related. We're living in a world where greed and military armament sales really rule. Those are the biggest ruling factors of the human race at this time. And we're in a very critical juncture in the history of mankind as we reach a limit of resources on this planet. And who will control those resources? That person, that entity, that country. And probably it won't be a country, it'll be a power group within a country, and therefore not the country itself in terms of the population. So we are at a very critical juncture in the human race, because we are finally realizing that we're very vulnerable in terms of objects from outer space having an effect on Earth. So at any rate, let me go into these topics, and I'm going to kind of bounce around between them and then get into the heart of the matter, which is control of resources. Now, this past week, it was announced that there is an asteroid, and of course this asteroid has been in the news before, so this is not exactly new news, but there's an estimate that an asteroid could come relatively close to Earth in the year 2036. Now, that's quite a ways away in terms of space and time, and so for someone to begin planning now a venture by which we would move an asteroid in hopes of it having it miss Earth in, that would be almost 30 years from now, quite a stretch of the imagination, but this is being used right now as a ploy for the United Nations to take over control of NASA. Now remember who is working in the background in the United Nations. A guy named Bill Clinton, who is estimated by many people, at least on the cover of Forbes magazine recently, about a year ago, to be the most powerful man in the world. And Bill works behind the scenes. You know, he goes around, he's a mover and shaker, he started his Clinton Worldwide Initiative, the Clinton Global Initiative, GCI, or CGI, I should say. And of course, this took place last year, 2006, as 140 nations met at the United Nations. Bill just happened to have a conference room there with invited guests from many of these countries. And of course, the topic was resources and global development under an umbrella called the Clinton Global Initiative. Now, a lot of countries were very offended by this. A lot of countries were quite angered. And you see who attended. At his right-hand side were Hillary Clinton, who I've talked about before, would be your next president if all goes according to plan. And also in attendance was Laura Bush, George W. Bush's wife, who, of course, they were having a little bit of marital problems at the time. I'm not going to go into that. But it's interesting that they were at this meeting at the UN, at the United States, the United Nations, Laura Bush and Hillary Clinton, and along with very wealthy people. It is, I was told, well, I'm not going to go into the laundry list of people who were there, but people who are wealthy in terms of billions of dollars. Now, Bill raised that day something like $30 billion for his Clinton Global Initiative, and this was to be used for development of countries around the world to establish this program. So it should not surprise you too much to find that somebody has been maneuvering in the background to take over one of the great resources of the United States. And of course, I'm a great critic of NASA, but you have to understand, as I've been telling you all along, that NASA is a front agency for the real space program. So in taking over the front agency, then this is kind of the official note of taking over the black ops and all of the background. The scientists, the science, the work that's being done, and it is being done in the name of saving the planet from being hit by an asteroid. And the estimated price tag on this venture is $300 million, U.S. dollars, 2007 U.S. dollars. That is $300 million in 2007 dollars registered this year, their value this year. So that is a valuable resource, and guess who goes along with it? All of our illustrious scientists. So everybody who is working for NASA right now has they've had their allegiance, in a sense, transferred, and it's being moved under the United Nations. Now, a lot of these scientists don't care as long as they get a paycheck every week, as long as they get to play with the really cool toys, that the expensive toys that we provide for them. And they really don't care who owns them, and they really don't think beyond what they're doing and who they're doing it for and what the ultimate implication is for the average person on the street. And this is the same mental attitude. Now, a lot of these people may think that they don't work in the war industry or whatever, but it's the same industry that came out of Washington, the same funding sources that provide money for the war industry. The corporations, the ones that you rarely hear about, everybody from Raytheon down, who provide the technology, the manpower, the skill for all types of black ops projects, Hughes, Ball Aerospace, the old McDonnell Douglas, Northrop, all of those companies which have now changed names, changed hands, and have been absorbed, Boeing, the list goes on and on. But the point is, these corporations, for example, Boeing has subsidiaries that are some of the largest corporations in the world in the military business, creating armaments, etc. So as you look at the what I would say is inevitable right now, since it's been announced, the UN taking over NASA, and in this is the shoe in the door, the one NASA program to save the world from an asteroid that could come in 30 years possibly. And I will be talking about the science of moving asteroids. That's one of the topics I will get into. But then you can start to see how this relates to the United States selling an anti-ballistic missile system to the Czech Republic. And Russia's response this past week was to tell the Czech Republic that they are now in the crosshairs of the Russian nuclear arsenal. And of course the Czech Republic replied and said, well, this is not a technology that would work against Russian rockets. And, of course, Russia is saying, we don't know exactly what you're buying, and, of course, it can always be upgraded. So it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that the power plays that are going on right now, and, by the way, Russia is, of course, selling Iran a high-tech radar system, and of course that went down last year just as the United States started its war rhetoric against Iran. And of course the United States said, you cannot sell, we don't want you selling this high-tech radar system to Iran, because of course this could cost American lives if we got into a skirmish with them. Interestingly enough, China came out this past week and announced that since the U.S. had subcontracted components, electrical components of the cruise missiles and other technologies used in warfare, that the United States subcontracted some of this technology to Taiwan and to China, that China now has a financial interest in the oil of Iran, because Iran sells a good deal of oil to China. China has said that it will go in to any conflict on the side of Iran. Now, isn't that interesting that we have turned over the bulk of U.S. manufacturing? You can't pick up anything today in the United States without it having a label on it, made in China. I don't care if it's a tool that you use yourself or if it's military hardware, it is made in China. So isn't it interesting that now China is turning against us in this upcoming battle in the Middle East over Iran. And of course that is over oil, because the Afghan pipeline has failed and the United States oil firms are pressuring the big boys in Washington to garner a path through Iran from the Caspian Sea, because the Russians are pumping the oil out of the Caspian Sea on the north, and these guys want to get a piece of the action too, free oil. In fact, as we're talking today, Mideastern. There's a meeting going on in Iraq to move the resources of oil over to international corporations, meaning the multinational U.S. corporations. So what we're seeing here is an international squabble over resources. Oil, of course, is all over the planet, and I've talked about these kind of resource battles before. But now you have an organization like the United Nations, which is getting its foot in the door to control NASA, which, of course, has pulled in trillions of dollars from the American economy. In fact, you could make a case for the following. If you simply never supported NASA in the history of the United States, if we never had a space program, if we didn't have Tang and Teflon, we would not have a national debt. Now, of course, you could make that case for many programs in the United States, but it comes out almost to the dollar from the 1960s when the United States space program was first ramped up. You could make a case that the entire United States national debt is equal to the amount of money that we have spent through NASA. And what exactly do we have for this? Not a whole lot that is visible. I should add that as a caveat, because there is actually a lot going on behind the scenes in black ops, in programs that you don't see, tremendous, tremendous amounts of money being spent in these industries, and what you see is a little Tonka toy size remote control vehicle, two of them running around the surface of Mars, and we think that that is what NASA is doing. That's just what they show the public. That's the carrot to make you think that something really special is going on at NASA and to keep sending your dollars. But remember, space is the last frontier, and that has not gone unescaped, unnoticed by the people who control this planet. So gaining control of NASA, and of course, doing it in the, they always use some technique that the public, they will always use some technique that the public will buy off on. And in this case, the game plan is to say the United Nations is going to oversee NASA in a program to divert an asteroid from crashing into Earth in the year 2036. Now, let's talk a little bit about this endeavor. The statistic that I saw said, and this was came out of a news report that was circulated quite widely over the past couple days, that this asteroid has a 1 in 45,000 chance of hitting Earth in the year 2036. Now, what if they move it, and it originally was not going to hit Earth? What if NASA moves it so that it does hit Earth just by accident? I wouldn't say that they would do it on purpose, but would you trust NASA to do anything right? Excuse me, but I bet there's a few people laughing out there with me, but this is not funny. Here's the situation. Take an asteroid out there moving around and say that through measurements, just as with this asteroid, scientists determined that it could come close to Earth during the next 30-year period, sometime in there. Okay, let's look at the conditions that have to be met. First of all, we would need extremely accurate measurements of the position and velocity of this object. We would also have to calculate using enormous amounts of computing power. We would have to calculate the orbit and attribute everything in the solar system down to even the smallest objects, because over a 30-year period, say there's an asteroid out there that we're not quite familiar with, And we don't include that in these calculations. And it happens to come close to this particular asteroid. Or say, for example, there are electrical effects that NASA does not include in their calculations. And those electrical effects can perturb the orbit of this asteroid so that NASA's calculations are totally incorrect. They move the asteroid using what they call a space tug and move the asteroid so that it, in fact, will hit Earth. As I said, would you trust NASA to do anything right? And my answer is, of course, I would imagine they'd try and do a good job, but I certainly wouldn't trust them to do it right after the fiascos we've seen, the shuttle crashes, we've seen the Hubble Space Telescope go up with a faulty mirror. Nobody ever tested it before they launched it. Even after years of development in which the reason for it being faulty, or the excuse they gave anyway, is because all of the various teams would not talk to each other. So given this history of NASA and not doing things right, would you trust them to move an asteroid that might hit Earth in 30 years? But that, be that as it may, that's the excuse that is being used for the United Nations to take over and get the shoe in the door, so to speak, to take over a piece of NASA. Okay, so let's go into the science of moving asteroids, of detecting asteroid position and velocity, and what exactly would it take to predict over a 30-year period that something may or may not hit Earth. And I'll just start out with this fundamental, basic statement. Given the best supercomputers that the military has, for example, in Hawaii, up in Haleakala, where the most powerful set of supercomputers exists, coupled to astronomical equipment owned by the military, given that equipment, the best equipment with the best programming, the best software available on the planet, they probably could not predict a collision of an asteroid with Earth any more than, I would say, 2 years in advance at most. So 30 years out is a stretch. And so, as with anything, oh, let's take an example, the Bush program to send a man to the moon. NASA now is 3 years into this alleged new moon program. They don't have a design. They've asked private companies, guys working in their garages, to design rockets and lunar lander modules. NASA itself has done nothing but hold a few meetings and talk with, there was a lot of talk going on, but absolutely no action. In fact, they've stated that it's going to be a requirement of some future generation to educate the rocket engineers that would build and design the rockets that would carry this alleged moon program forward. So NASA doesn't intend to do anything. They're just pushing it off to some future generation, and 20 years is a long time away. So as you remember, in the 60s, when the Apollo program started, it was about probably 1963 when the real initiative began, and allegedly they went to the moon by 1969. So why would it take 20 years today when it only took 7 years back then, with far fewer resources, far less technology, far less manpower, far less capability in the aerospace industry? And now it's supposed to take 20 years? Who's fooling who? But at any rate, that's just an example of the ineptitude of NASA. But getting back to the story of dealing with asteroids, as I said, given the most sophisticated telescopic equipment that the military has, the military search programs looking for near-Earth asteroids and aliens and any other thing that moves out in outer space, the military, at best, could predict a possible hit of an asteroid to Earth with, at most, out probably 2 years. And here's the reason why. You need very accurate data. And that's something that's very difficult to get, because when you look at an object with telescopes, it's a moving object, and you basically make calculations based on measurements and repeated measurements, and those measurements are only as good as your observations. I've talked before about margins of error, and given 30 years, if you have a small margin of error in your velocity and position determination, then that is going to multiply and multiply and multiply. And let's say you're using a supercomputer to make calculations. You're assuming that your values of position and velocity and direction, etc., of this asteroid are accurate down to a certain level. But the problem is the error is going to multiply and multiply and multiply, and over a period of 30 years, the error alone would be sufficient to, the accumulative error would be, and this is assuming you have exact computing systems, something we simply do not have. But if you had perfectly exact computing systems, just the error alone in position and measurements of initial position, velocity, and the direction of motion of this asteroid would be sufficient to cause enough error that you could not predict, certainly not 30 years out. And so the other catch to this is that the least amount of work, if you move something just a little, in 30 years, that movement, that slight motion, that slight change in the direction or velocity of that asteroid is going to give a tremendous result, a difference in the orbit over a 30-year period. So you would want to do this as soon as possible, but if you do this 30 years in advance, then your error and your ability to calculate exactly where to move this and how far to move it, your ability to calculate exactly what to do with this asteroid is very limited. And as I said, you may in fact be moving it exactly into an orbit that will crash with Earth. Then there are factors in the middle that you know nothing about. What if a comet, say we move this asteroid, and everybody says, oh good, now it's in an orbit where it will not collide with Earth. In the next 30 years, what's the probability that maybe a large comet would come through the solar system and affect the orbit of this object, moving it in a direct collision course with Earth? What's the probability? Well, it's fairly low, but the point is that you cannot predict that, because the comets that are going to come into the solar system, the majority, especially the big ones, we don't know about yet. So there's no way to truly know what could happen. Let's introduce electrical effects. When an object, such as an asteroid, is in outer space, it's discharging the solar capacitor just like any comet. And the tail drag is going to alter the orbit. NASA doesn't know anything about this type of activity, and therefore the perturbations, by the way, those perturbations due to electrical activity where the charged asteroid draws in material, those activities are at best random, because we don't have the ability to understand when or where the tail drag will increase or decrease or change. And that's one of the properties of comets and asteroids, is it's very difficult to predict their orbits because of the randomness, the seeming randomness of the orbital conditions And so if you look at comets, they've always been called the lawless ones because they simply do not obey celestial mechanics. And that is because, well, of course, the standard theory says, the astronomical sturdy snowball idea is that there is jetting. The jets come off, and of course, the concept based on my plasma discharge comet model is that the tail drag is what causes the change in orbital position, velocity, etc., of a comet, and the same is true of an asteroid. So now you have NASA going out there willy-nilly, not knowing what it's doing, thinking that they're going to calculate an orbit, missing possibly one of the major components of the orbital dynamics of that asteroid, and thinking that they are going to go and move this asteroid so it will miss Earth in 30 years. Now, the other problem is more fundamental. And here's the problem. As an asteroid starts to approach the Earth-Moon system, it will start to interact with both the Earth and the Moon. Now, this is an extremely complicated calculation because since we're just making an estimate of when this object might come near Earth in 30 years, the Moon could be in a very different position, maybe by a day or two, maybe by a week or so, different than what the NASA calculations would show. That would be enough to change the orbit of this object so that it would possibly collide with Earth. Do you start to see all of the factors involved with timing, with position, with understanding precise initial conditions, and then understanding that if you move something, you might, in fact, be moving it into a path where it will collide with Earth. So I'm trying to, I'm being somewhat repetitive here, but I want to drive home the point that NASA simply does not have the information to make a decision on what to do with this asteroid. But the point is, the United Nations, or the body, or the front agency, which we call the United Nations, is being used to take our illustrious space agency out from under our wing. Now, isn't that interesting? So let me talk just a little bit more about the Czech Republic and the anti-ballistic missile system. Here is another fairy tale in the making. The anti-ballistic missile system, and every scientist that I know, every well-trained scientist, in fact, I am very familiar with this system because during the Reagan Star Wars program, there were numerous scientists who came and talked to me about many of the problems they were having with the anti-ballistic missile system, including the infrared sensors, etc. So I'm not going to go into detail about that, but those problems have not gone away. And whenever you start developing an anti-ballistic missile system, you have two problems. First of all, it's like any system. It has flaws, and if the other side finds out what those flaws are, it can overcome the anti-ballistic missile system. And the best way to overcome an anti-ballistic missile system is just to build more rockets, causing an increase in the instability, the nuclear instability of the world. And that's why anti-ballistic missile systems were outlawed in the nuclear ban treaties that were developed back in the 70s and 80s, because scientists and politicians finally figured out back then that anti-ballistic missile systems simply caused more harm than good and would just create a very unstable situation, so they were actually banned. Now they're back. Now they're back. Here we have them again, and the United States is selling them to a bloc country of Russia. Now, what if in 5 years the Czech Republic decides to get buddy-buddy with Russia? Or with some rogue nation? Or what if China comes and develops an interest in the Czech Republic. They now have control of our most sensitive technology, the anti-ballistic missile system, the same system that allegedly is supposed to protect us. You're starting to see the picture here. Some company is trying to make a quick buck, not knowing what the future will bring. Now, have you ever seen before where the United States has entered into an agreement or a negotiation or a sale to another country only to have it backfire? And Iraq is one of the best examples where the United States, the CIA, set up a guy named Saddam Hussein in Iraq and supported him for decades only to have the situation erupt that we see today. So you don't have to go very far to understand this, but at the basis of this are the scientists who developed these programs, and this is the next step. This is where I'm going with both of these arguments, both the United Nations taking over NASA and the anti-ballistic missile system, which is now being sold on the open market internationally for a profit, even though it was allegedly developed to protect our shores from hostile rogue nations. Here is the point. Who owns science and the scientists? Now, I'm sure that the scientists who developed the anti-ballistic missile system, the people in the military who worked to perform tests on the system, I bet they didn't know that this was eventually, before it was even out of the box, I bet they didn't know that they were developing it for a country like the Czech Republic. I bet you that the scientists working at NASA today, after spending their careers developing scientific concepts, even though I believe that most of them are false, I bet you these scientists didn't have no idea that their allegiance would be sold to the United Nations. Not even sold, simply taken over. And if they want to continue performing science, they're going to have to bow to a different dictator. So I'm going to read a list of resources here that are extremely valuable, and these have already been identified, and their ownership is being mandated and taken over. Science and scientists, water, information and information flow, commerce and money systems, and in general, resources both on Earth and in outer space. I just want to make a comment here. As the United States moves out in aggressive, warlike considerations in Iraq, Iran, Afghanistan, and other countries realize that they are going to be a target someday, in the quest for resources, we are going back to the days of the Old West, of Genghis Khan and the Roman Empire, where the person that could take and defend something, if you could do that, it was yours. If you took something and could not defend it, then it was not yours. And the question was, how far are you going to go to defend whatever you have against the ownership being taken over? Now, I want to get back to this idea of ownership of water because it's so critical today. Just one of the worldwide resources, and the way they do this is they come into the communities, they set up the infrastructure, they prevent you from having your own source of water, prevent you from drilling a well, and then they will administer the water, and then that water rights, which basically the people in the city thought that's their water, that's under their land, is that water, the rights to that water is going to be taken over by private corporations, all in the name of economy, of saving the city or the county money. Just imagine, it's a cost-saving move. And who would be opposed to such a cost-saving move? But not realizing that with any monopoly, first someone comes in, takes over, then everything goes along great for a little while, and then all of a sudden the price goes up. Where have you seen this before? And water, you people do not understand that water is being controlled worldwide. And as I said before, there's a three-step process in controlling water, as it is with any resource, whether it's timber, whether it's oil, no matter what the control is, there's a three-step process. First of all, you have to identify the resource. That's where the scientists come in. That's where the geologists come in. That's where the hydrologists come in. They go out and they identify the resource. They are making their living doing this. They think they're doing a good job. They think they're doing this to conserve the resource. And also what they're doing is providing the people sitting in the background, the large corporations, the bottled water corporations, etc., they're providing these corporations with valuable data. That's information, and information has value. So without the geologists running around doing their job as good little scientists on the payroll, these corporations would not be able to succeed and accomplish the first stage of taking over your water supply. That is, the first stage is identifying the resource. Where is it? How much is there? How can they move in, create legislation to, in fact, take over your water supply? The second stage is very interesting. That's building the infrastructure, building the delivery system for water, just like they did with oil. Remember, we don't have an oil shortage in the world. We have a distribution problem, and at the bottleneck of that distribution problem are the international oil companies, the ones that started in the U.S., Exxon, Mobil, etc. So the same technique was used for oil, the same technique was used for timber, for coal, and these organizations, these corporations, whatever you want, these entities control the political maneuvering. We could have wind power in this country. Remember that with the cost of the Iraq war, we could have built a wind power infrastructure in this country so we would never have to pay for energy ever again. This is just based on wind power, not Tesla energy, not other sources of energy. Energy based on currently available wind technology, the cost of the Iraq war could have provided the entire United States with the wind infrastructure so that we would be completely free of oil forever. That's not just Mideast oil, that's all sources of oil. So this is just giving you an idea of control of resources and manipulation so that corporations can, in fact, control these resources. Water control is the next big item, the next big ticket item, and it's the one item that you need even more than oil. So stage two in taking over the water resources is building the infrastructure, the delivery system, and then stage three is tightening down the clamps, creating the water shortages that allow them to give you less water and charge you more. And then they can take the other water, bottle it, and sell it on the open market, and once again, raising the cost of water, of your daily water requirement. And part of this whole program, too, is to pass laws to prevent you from having a well in your very own yard. Isn't that interesting? So the three stages of taking over natural resources, identify the resources. Look at everything I've talked about. Science, scientists, information, commerce, resources, space resources, earth resources. We have scientists who have spent their careers ferreting out information for what they believe is a good cause, identifying they're doing the work that they love to do, but that information they're developing, whether it's regarding oil or coal or timber or water or whatever it is, they're developing bases of information that are then being pulled back by the controllers, and that is an essential piece, that is the very first essential piece of taking over the Earth resources, identification of the resources. The second one is the distribution process, and you can see that with scientists, with science. Controlled monopoly from government-supported science. All these scientists, whether they work in industry, for the aerospace industry, or for the military industry, whether they work under federal grants, whether they work under National Science Foundation, National Institute of Health, all of these alphabet agencies, whether it's under NASA, you name it, they all get their funding from that central source, that golden egg out east called Washington, D.C. Very few scientists, and I refuse to work for any government agency. I refuse to have anything to do with these people. And every time I get a chance, I stick it in their ear to let them know that they are prostitutes. They have sold their training and their energy and their ability to develop ideas and pass this on to new people and develop systems that will then generate new higher technology systems. They have sold this information. It doesn't belong to the scientists. Who owns the science and the scientists? So the same process is used to garner the science and scientific resources in the United States and around the planet. And as NASA moves out to meetings, whether it's in Mexico, whether it's in China, whether it's in Scandinavia or Europe, or whether it's in any other country in the world, the thing that NASA does, and they have outreach programs in all of these areas of the world, the thing that they're doing is influencing scientists in other countries as those countries come online and become gain a higher technology base. They're including them in this mix. And the scientists don't really know it, but what they're doing is drawing the scientists of other countries into this resource base that is being funneled off and controlled by a central few people, the knowledge, information, science base as a resource. And then the third stage, of course, is clamping down on the resources, because all of these people have become accustomed to being fed at the trough, the government funding trough, and that's all they know. I believe I've talked in this show about when I go to meetings, international science meetings, and I go there and I have my tag on and it says independent scientist. And I can't tell you how many times people come up to me and they look at that. They're, of course, looking at your name and your affiliation. And they say, what is an independent scientist? And I tell them that I don't have any affiliations with the government or corporations, that I'm an independent scientist. And their absolute first question is, who funds your research? And I say, I do. And they can't understand what I'm talking about. How could you possibly not work under a government grant? Or under a grant that came through the government through a corporation or a think tank? They simply cannot fathom that. And these are people that all have PhDs, they all are trained, and they live at the government trough. Their entire existence revolves around it, and they don't own anything that they do. Everything that they do is controlled by someone else. They're told what to do, and it all comes back to funding. So the science and scientists, water, information. Look at the few corporations that own the information industry, and I actually get quite a kick out of this, because right now there's a lot of anger coming out of the information industry. networks, the news networks, the you know, standard information networks, a good deal of anger towards bloggers, because bloggers are trying to hold people accountable for what they say. The Bushes hate bloggers because, you know, the bloggers are just relentless at pointing out what Bush said, or old man Bush, or what the flaws, because what do the Bushes do? They own the information flow so that they only print good things about the Bushes. No matter what's going on, the present case of Britain pulling their troops out of Iraq, they're saying, oh, that's because everything's better there now. Well, why don't you put these troops that Britain is withdrawing, put them up into Baghdad to help out the American troops? They won't talk about that. See, the problem with information is that it is controlled. So I think it's great that there is the internet, that you have bloggers who are holding these people accountable, and more people are going to the blogs to get their news and turning away from the standard news information sources, just as more and more people listen to this radio show to try and get a handle on what's really going on this planet and outside of the planet, because they know they're simply not going to get a straight answer from NASA or the standard news media that represents the standard science news media that is the mouthpiece for NASA and government science. So at any rate, there's just one last point that I want to make here. I want to reiterate that if you have something, then in the days that we're seeing coming up, if you have something, then you have to be prepared to defend it yourself, because nobody else is going to do anything. The courts are worthless. So simply, you are on your own. If you want to go out and get something and keep it, you're going to have to keep it and defend it yourself. So I guess the bottom line is, don't have anything that you're not willing to defend and keep. And, of course, there's always a bigger sword. There's always a faster gun. And as I said, we're in the stages of the Old West, where the fastest gun ruled or whatever. And I don't believe personally in guns myself. I just want to make that clear, but that's just an expression that the days of the Old West are back again. The days of Genghis Khan riding in and taking over, and what he takes, he keeps, because he's just powerful enough to do so. And eventually there's somebody that's going to take over and become bigger than that. So we're in that stage where we were headed a number of years ago into a peaceful state on this earth. North Korea was joining the economic revolution, getting away from the Cold War, etc. All that is reversed. Everything that has been built to bring this world into a peaceful setting, everything is down the drain. It is standing right now in utter chaos. And that brings up the final point. Are we in a position here where all we're doing is muddling around on this planet with greed, with selfishness, with control, and with leaders that are out of control and crazy running the planet, and every day we creep closer to basically a worldwide annihilation event with some object from outer space, possibly a major object coming into the solar system, one of our Planet X friends? And this is the point. The point is that nature has ways of taking care of errant societies, of errant civilizations that don't understand the rules of engagement, that we have resources, we have tremendous resources, but we're using them against ourselves. We're using them to create petty wars and fund petty wars into the distant future, and the grand human experiment is a grand failure. So this is the ultimate situation And nature works on its own time scale, and that's what's very interesting. These events come along every now and then. We may go another year, another 5 years, another 10 years, another 100 years, another 1,000 years, developing as a civilization without any major events. But eventually, because of the petty wars and the wasting of resources that waste of resource that is going on right now, it will ultimately be the demise of the human race. It could be the, for example, just like the asteroid, the waste of resources now, just as with an asteroid, a small perturbation in its orbit right now would have a great effect 30 years from now, just as our wasting resources right now could be the impetus that the human race would need in 30 years to actually make it beyond our planet, to get into outer space in a permanent mode and save the civilization, save the human race. But it's not going to happen because of the waste of resources that is going on right now. There's a fundamental point where the people of this planet have to reverse this. There's a tremendous awareness going on amongst people on this planet, and they realize, the average person on the street realizes, that they have to do something to turn this around. But unfortunately, we've turned all of our power, our resources over, and they're centralized in this powerful government and the powerful governments around the world, and those are being run by madmen, is the best word I can use. So we're from all corners of the world, these resources are being wasted. And when one country moves out and becomes aggressive and causes a response from other countries, then there's only one result. That's what we call gridlock. Gridlock is like in a traffic situation where nobody can move because everybody is trying to get someplace to make a right or a left turn, but if they make a left turn, then the guy over there cannot make a right turn. That's gridlock. The world today is in gridlock based on the irrational behavior of world leaders and our inability to get this world back, to get the planet back, and get control of our resources. Scientists are at the center of this, and this is why I brought up the point about the UN taking over NASA, the anti-ballistic missile system, and I listed science and scientists as the first set of resources that have been taken over and that are being controlled, and 99.9% of all of the PhD scientists in the United States work under government control of some type. And the ones that don't, the very few that do not, like myself, have to deal with very few resources. And I would rather do that than sell my soul to the dollar, to the control of government monopolized science. Once again, water, information, commerce, resources, earth and outer space, science and scientists being the resources that are being nabbed as we speak. I'm out of time. Join me next week, and I should, by the middle of this coming week, be announcing the radio shows for the release of the new book. So stay tuned, please, and thank you for your patience. It will be out shortly. Once again, this is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour, and as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.